and politics. A Gallup poll conducted less than a month before the election found that Americans' trust in mainstream media had fallen to an all-time low. Just 32% said they had a great deal or a fair amount of trust in the media. It's the lowest figure Gallup had recorded since they began polling in 1972. And just 10 years previously, the figure stood at 50%. Even Democrats, catered to by the media, endlessly pandered to and mollycoddled by mainstream journalists, are still lukewarm on the subject. Gallup found that just 51% of them had a great deal or a fair amount of trust in the media, compared to 30% of independents and a shockingly low 14% of Republicans, which is roughly the same number of people who supported John Kasich. Trust in the media is in particular decline among younger people. In 2016, 26% of 18 to 49-year-olds trusted the media, down from 43% in 2011. For the older generation, 50 and over, trust only declined by 6 points in the same period, from 44% in 2011 to 38% in 2016. In other words, the few people who still trust the American media will soon be dead. Isn't it deliciously ironic that the children of the 1960s, that era when the young rose up against the heroic, selfless World War II generation, are now stuck in the same old jam as their grandparents? After working so hard to destroy conservative principles, they settled into a sort of lazy complacency, foolishly believing they'd won the culture war forever. But now they have to watch as their own children rise up against them in glorious rebellion, embracing the very principles they sought to destroy. So the children of the 70s and the 80s listen to punk rock instead of Walter Cronkite. Well, the children of the 2010s read 4chan and watch my live roasts of feminism. They're not watching Anderson Cooper. It's some kind of cosmic justice, and the media has no way to dig itself out of this mess. They are stuck in the biggest circle jerk I've ever seen. And trust me, I've seen big ones. Their primary goal is no longer to convey the latest information about current events to the American public. It is no longer to hold the powerful to account. They've given up on their historic responsibility to safeguard democracy. Instead, the primary purpose, it seems to me, of American journalism is to demonstrate the journalists' own commitment to the politically correct worldview of their peers in a metropolitan bubble. Most of the leading lights of American journalism have lost any interest in objective news reporting. Those who do report are terrified of being ostracized, so they go along with the virtue signaling. And as a result, any good journalism they eventually do come out with is ignored by an increasingly disgusted and disillusioned public. That's why they missed the very obvious rise of Donald Trump. Trump and I have, of course, many of the same supporters. If the media wanted to judge where the wind was blowing, they should have paid attention to my soaring Google rankings and those of other mischievous young libertarian and conservative artists, commentators, and thinkers. But the media didn't want to see the signs. In their worldview, Mitt Romney's failed bid for president in 2012 proved the dominance of the new Democratic coalition of urban voters and minorities. They grew drunk on the delusion of their own unassailable power. Not every journalist working in the mainstream media failed to see the tsunami that was about to engulf the Democrats and their allies in the media elites, but those who suspected it was coming decided keeping their heads down was the best career move. A couple of examples prove that they likely made the right choice. When Huffington Post blogger David Seaman published 2 articles for the site breaking with the left wing and mainstream media's self-imposed vow of silence about Hillary Clinton's health, retribution was swift and merciless. Not only were his 2 articles on the subject deleted, they had the headlines, "Hillary's health is superb, aside from seizures, lesions, adrenaline pens," and "Donald Trump challenges Hillary Clinton to health records duel." But the writer was also fired, locked out of his editing account, and then his entire history of articles was temporarily scrubbed from the website. Understandably mystified, Seaman took to YouTube to express his astonishment. He said, quote, "Whenever a video concerning a presidential candidate's health is viewed more than 3.5 million times, somebody under contract to the Huffington Post should be able to link to it, especially as a journalist living in the US without having their account revoked. I've filed hundreds of stories over my years as a journalist and pundit, and I've never had anything like this happen." End quote. Seaman was not the only example. There's also Michael Tracy, who was a reporter for Vice, whose relentless Hillary bashing was tolerated during the primaries when Tracy was a vocal supporter of Bernie Sanders. But once Clinton won her victory over Sanders, His views were suddenly unwelcome, but he persisted, repeatedly highlighting the failings of Hillary Clinton on social media in the months leading up to the election. On September 6, 2016, he published one of the election cycle's more prescient columns. "The mainstream media has a Donald J. Trump-sized blind spot," read the headline. But tellingly, it wasn't published at his home turf at Vice, but instead at the Daily Beast. In his column, Tracy described how the media's tactics were backfiring. Quote, "I can't tell you how many ordinary folks I've spoken with who don't trust that the rolling Trump outrage machine, otherwise known as current mainstream media, is giving them the real story. This includes people who generally dislike Trump. One representative example was a restaurant worker in Philadelphia during the Democratic convention in July, who told me that she assumes anything Trump does or says will instantly be blown out of proportion, so she's decided just to ignore the coverage. For her, it's a rational reaction to such disproportionate, all-consuming furore. She says she cannot process it all and also retain her sanity. So even if a controversy arises that is legitimately worth getting up in arms about, she will no longer know about it." End quote. Tracy was right, and the mainstream media, as well as the National Review writers who assumed Trump would surely lose, were all wrong. Not only did they fail to anticipate that Trump's unstoppable momentum would carry him to the White House, they also likely aided the process by crying wolf, confecting controversy, and pretending to be offended and outraged so many times that the voting public just switched off. Presumably, Tracy's superiors at Vice aren't big fans of "I told you so," so they quickly found an excuse to get rid of him after the election. They didn't even care that his readership appeared to be growing. He had to go. Unwilling to be as blatant in their pro-Clinton bias as the Huffington Post, Vice instead opted to fire Tracy after he pointed out that Lena Dunham could not have participated in the closed Democratic primary in New York, as she claimed, because she was not registered with the party. Vice fired him for reprinting a screenshot of publicly accessible, easily searchable voter registration data. I don't think Tracy or Seaman will end up with their careers particularly damaged in the long term. They were right, after all, and their furious progressive editors were wrong. They won't want for employment in the new media ecosystem, provided they can hold their nose and work for an alternative outlet. But in addition to creating a chilling effect in the mainstream media, where journalists decline to defy the narrative out of fear for their jobs, this also shows how committed the mainstream media is to remaining in its cycle of error. The few reporters who do see past the biases of the bubble are purged, and that's why the cycle keeps continuing. I have some good news for Japan's politicians and for anyone else wondering where to look for truth in this new age of progressive propaganda masquerading as impartial journalism. You see, as virtue signaling intensifies and the Overton window, which is the range of ideas acceptable in political discussion, grows narrower, it's no longer just the cranks and the UFO hunters who are left outside the mainstream. Journalists and fact hunters who actually do know what's going on in the world are being left outside the tent too. So if you want to know when the next Donald J. Trump is coming around the corner, all you have to do is find them. I'm of course referring in part to myself, in part to my former colleagues at Breitbart, to my new comrades at Milo Inc., and of course to all my fellow travellers in the anti-establishment press, the very people and publications that are frantically decried by the opposition as fake news. They don't understand why our star is rising and theirs is falling. Well, I'll tell them. It's because we're upfront about our opinions and priorities and committed to reporting the stories that the discredited mainstream routinely ignores. We also have respect for our readers. Unlike most of the press, we don't look down our noses at ordinary Americans. I made a lot of mistakes when I was younger. I dropped out of college, which I should never have done. I spent way too much time blowing drug dealers, which was probably fine. I should have resisted Father Michael's advances, but picking journalism as a career was by far my biggest mistake. It's not a path I'd advise anyone else to take unless you fancy answering to miserable, soft-spoken nerds in plaid shirts who want to convince the public that Islam is nothing to be worried about and mansplaining is a serious threat to women everywhere. If you are a journalist, tell the truth. Tell the truth. Your career options will be limited initially, but honesty pays off where it matters, with readers. And you don't even have to be right-wing. I trust anti-establishment leftists like Michael Tracy far more than I trust National Review or Red State columnists, who have revealed themselves during the campaign to be little more than watered-down versions of the virtue-signaling mainstream. The alternative media is increasingly difficult to ignore. Breitbart, for example, maintained the top spot in political news on Facebook and Twitter for most of the 2016 election year. And despite the best efforts of biased Silicon Valley CEOs to silence our leading voices, we are the ones the people want to share and we are the ones people want to hear. During my career as a tech journalist in Europe, I quickly learned that tech journalism is a corrupt mess populated by hacks. Then, during Gamergate, we learned the gaming press is a corrupt mess populated by hacks not interested in the hobby, merely in politicizing it. Now, during this election, I learned that the entire mainstream media is a corrupt mess populated by hacks pushing the political views of those in power with zealotry and mendacity. Just a few years ago, you'd have been laughed out of any reasonable crowd for saying stuff like that, but now everyone knows it's true. You'd expect the mainstream media to show a little humility after Trump's victory, but instead, they've doubled down in an ill-conceived attempt to take vengeance on those who humiliated them, but their efforts are backfiring utterly. Instead of asking themselves why they lost people's trust, the media is instead asked why people lost trust in them. A subtle but an important difference. You see, the media decided that people who'd been duped because they were listening to, reading, and watching shock horror alternative media, and something had to be done about that, but they didn't know what. The mainstream media could always engage with the alternative media and its arguments directly, but that would require patience, facts, evidence, debate, open-mindedness, and other long-forgotten qualities, so they didn't do that. The media could start listening to its readers again if it didn't want to engage with us by reopening comment sections and engaging with what readers had to say rather than writing off all criticism as trolling, abuse, and harassment. But that would require humility and the ability to admit that perhaps the backward losers in the flyover states know a thing or two once in a while. So they didn't do that. In the days following the presidential election, the media seized on a new meme emerging from left-wing academics and analysts desperate for a reason to absolve them of responsibility for losing America. That meme was fake news. The idea that Donald Trump had won because of the power of social media to spread misinformation. Voters' anger at elites wasn't legitimate. It was all the alternative media. It was all fake news sites and mean-spirited lies about poor old Hillary. There are sites on the internet that create entirely fictitious fake news stories. You can often spot them because they have a suffix .co or they look a little bit like a regular news site, but they're not really. Well, just because a couple of them are out there doesn't mean that the whole of the media that you don't like, the alternative media, is all fake. But that's precisely what the media set about trying to prove. Two false stories about high-profile endorsements of Trump, one from Pope Francis and one from Denzel Washington, and one activist's mistaken photo about bust-in anti-Trump protesters in Austin, Texas, were used by the media to paint a picture of a deluded electorate. Breitbart, for instance, didn't report on any of those stories, but along with InfoWars, Prison Planet, The Blaze, Project Veritas, Private Eye, The Independent Journal Review, WorldNet Daily, and Zero Hedge, Breitbart was placed on a list compiled by a left-wing academic of so-called fake news sites. And it wasn't just the alternative media. Even more liberal independent sites like Red State and The Daily Wire made the list too. Part of the reason why the left was drawn so rapidly to the fake news meme was because it offered the hope of striking back at a freewheeling new anti-establishment media that was rapidly supplanting them. In the age of the internet, the public has any number of independent commentators to choose from, and their soaring popularity is a testament to the media's failure to hang on to their own audiences. Take Steven Crowder, once a Fox News contributor who now enjoys far more freedom in his widely watched YouTube show, Louder with Crowder. There's Stefan Molyneux, whose piercing insight into the issues of the day is far more exciting and intellectually stimulating than anything Keith Olbermann or Sally Cohn has to offer. There's Joe Rogan of the wildly successful podcast The Joe Rogan Experience, whose monthly download numbers, 11 million in a single month in 2014, should terrify the mainstream media. And there's also Gavin McInnes, one of the only Canadians I can tolerate. Uber straight Gavin and I kissed at a press conference after the Orlando terrorist attack, which was a sort of symbolic fuck you to radical Islam. It was a bit like the conservative version of Madonna kissing Britney at the VMAs, although it didn't get quite the same coverage. The real crisis of mainstream credibility can be seen in the rise of the alt-media, people who were previously considered crackpots and fringe loons. The InfoWars commentators Alex Jones and Paul Joseph Watson now rack up hundreds of thousands and even millions of views with every YouTube broadcast they release. What does it say about the mainstream media's credibility when a man known to accuse the federal government of turning the freaking frogs gay is on the rise while they're on the decline? Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are also symbols of the mainstream media's declining power. Once upon a time, a leaker or a whistleblower would have to go to a newspaper or a broadcaster in order to get their story out. When the media is biased, this can be a problem. Remember, Newsweek passed on the story of President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. It was Matt Drudge who ended up leaking the story online. But now the map has changed. WikiLeaks can dump virtually any leaks from government and political parties directly on the web, almost completely uncensored. Sure, the media could just ignore them, but if they don't spread the news, social media users will, and they'll end up looking really fucking stupid. Now, aware of the existential threat posed to his world order, even outgoing President Barack Obama got involved. According to The New Yorker, just a few days after the election, Obama was talking obsessively about a BuzzFeed article attacking pro-Trump fake news sites. In his public statements, Obama also blamed fake news for the public's lack of belief in man-made climate change. Obama said, quote, "The capacity to disseminate misinformation, wild conspiracy theories, to paint the opposition in wildly negative light without any rebuttal, that has accelerated in ways that much more sharply polarized the electorate," end quote. You could be forgiven for thinking he was talking about CNN. Just how polarizing and negative are these fake news sites? Are they writing inflammatory stories about their political opponents with headlines like, "This is how fascism comes to America"? Well, I don't know about that. I mean, that headline was the Washington Post in an article about, you guessed it, Donald Trump. Are they suggesting, these fake news sites, that their opponents will commit genocide if elected? No, that was an op-ed in the New York Times, also about, yes, Donald Trump. The phrase, "just say it, Trump sounds more and more like Hitler," was that a fake news site? No, that was Slate, a once respectable magazine that published Christopher Hitchens but now spends its time calling me a neo-Nazi. And what about the unverified dossier claiming that the Russian government is blackmailing Donald Trump with evidence of him engaged in perverted sexual acts that were monitored by Russian intelligence? Well, that one was published on BuzzFeed and reported on, of course, by CNN. Obama's right, for once. There is a problem with hysterics and misinformation in the press, but it's a problem in the mainstream press, not the alternative media. It's a bit rich for journalists who got absolutely everything wrong about this election and who published biased polls assuring the public of Hillary's victory to start complaining after the fact about fake news because they lost the election. One of the fake news media's most common targets has been me. I partly forgive them for this because my daily skincare regime is more complex and at least as interesting as national news events, but I don't forgive the lies. Just Google Milo Yiannopoulos and the terms alt-right and white supremacist or white nationalist and count the number of times I've falsely been called these things. You'll find articles from CNN, CBS, NBC, The Los Angeles Times, The Chicago Tribune, and USA Today, almost all of them issued groveling retractions and in some cases apologies after my lawyers got in touch and it became clear I was not the sort of person to let their smear stand without a fight. But by that point, most people have already read the story and the damage has been done. People have formed their opinion. A supposedly respectable place, NPR, called me a self-proclaimed leader of the alt-right. That's not true. Not only have I repeatedly said I'm not a member of the alt-right, but self-proclaimed is absolutely wrong. Britain's Daily Telegraph, and I used to write a column for them, so they must have gone downhill since I left, and Bloomberg Businessweek both called me the face of the alt-right. Again, wrong. At least Bloomberg Businessweek did it in so inadvertently gracious a manner that I couldn't help but be flattered. They called me pretty and monstrous, but it doesn't make what they claimed any more true. Less flattering but no less false, CNN wrote an article including me in a list of white nationalists and accused me of speaking disparagingly about Jews. These are all mainstream, respectable publications and outlets staffed by professional journalists, the very same people that we are supposed to believe will provide the public with real and not fake news. Yet this is how they behave toward even the mildest of disagreement. It's a constant game of virtue signaling and vice signaling, telling others whom to shun by slapping the latest negative buzzword on them and then gloating contentedly and calling themselves the good guys. If the media only went after provocateurs like me, I guess that would be all right. I do, after all, wind people up for a living, so I expect a little heat and I can look after myself. But they also go after people whose contributions to society consist of more than just barbed words and fabulous hair. People like Martin Shkreli, who they accused of fleecing HIV and AIDS sufferers by raising the price of Daraprim, a drug that treats a number of relatively rare conditions associated with HIV and AIDS. Shkreli had a reason for raising the price. He wanted to fund research for a cheaper, better alternative. And his company, Turing Pharmaceuticals, made it clear that it was health insurers and corporations, not the financially disadvantaged, who would be out of pocket. But that didn't stop the media from branding Shkreli the most hated man in America. He might be no angel, but the Daraprim price hike is only grounds for hatred if you're a misinformed lefty or a mainstream journalist who doesn't understand how the free market works. They act like Regina George in Mean Girls, victimizing anyone who could be a threat to their popularity, only to discover at the end of the movie that nobody likes them anyway. Having realized that the fake news meme was now being used to shine a light on their own failings, the mainstream media desperately tried to put the genie back in the bottle. The Washington Post released an article saying it was time to retire the tainted term fake news, and CNN constantly asks viewers not to use the expression. But it's too late. The media has given the world this phrase, and it has come back to bite them. Unable to face up to their own problems, the metropolitan media political bubble has opted for projection instead. So there's nothing for it. We have to strap them to a chair, tape their eyes open, and make them look in the mirror. And that's why, even though it's probably for nothing in the end, I make a point of ritually humiliating journalists who lie about me. Because if I can make them think twice about doing it to me, maybe they'll think twice about doing it to you. For all those lying journalists who haven't felt my wrath yet, I have a very particular set of skills, as they say, waiting for you, and you'll see soon enough. On November 21st, as Donald Trump was preparing for his transition to office, he called some of the biggest names in American news media to Trump Tower. These journalists expected the meeting to be about access to the Trump administration during its time in office, but instead, they received a historic dressing down, what one source at the meeting described to the New York Post as a, quote, fucking firing squad. Trump kept saying, "We're in a room of liars, the deceitful, dishonest media who got it all wrong." He addressed everyone in the room, calling the media dishonest, deceitful liars. He called out Jeff Zucker by name and said everyone at CNN was a liar, and CNN was a network of liars, the source said. Trump didn't say NBC reporter Katie Tour by name, but talked about an NBC female correspondent who got it wrong. Then he referred to a horrible network correspondent who cried when Hillary lost, who hosted a debate. And that was Martha Raddatz, who was also in the room. End quote. Kellyanne Conway would go on to tell reporters in the lobby of Trump Tower that the meeting was excellent. I like to imagine her smirking internally as she said it. She's one of my favorites. Trump has been manipulating the media for decades with almost unparalleled brilliance. But I think they only really figured out they were being played in September 2016, because Trump announced he was going to make a statement on the birther conspiracy about Barack Obama at the soft opening of his new hotel in Washington, D.C. This brought what seemed like the entirety of America's political press corps to Trump's doorstep. They expected he was going to say something crazy, the final wacky comment that would sink his campaign. But instead, reporters found themselves covering the opening of a new Trump hotel, and 20 minutes of veterans arriving in front of the cameras to endorse his run for president. Finally, at the very end, Trump appeared on stage to give a two-line comment on the birther issue. "President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to go back to making America strong and great again. Thank you very much," he said. "The press went crazy. I don't know what to say here," said CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. "We got played again by the campaign." Meanwhile, Jake Tapper, live on air, called it a political rickroll. Tapper perhaps thought he was insulting Trump for engaging in the political equivalent of a prank invented by internet trolls, but everyone else, including me, thought it was hilarious. It was the perfect troll. It revealed suppressed truths, dismayed and entertained the public in equal measure, and gloriously humiliated a deserving target, the media. Only Daddy could have done it. I was one of the first major conservative commentators to back Trump. My headline published on Breitbart called Trump the king of trolling his critics and argued that he would be the internet's choice for president. And at the time, not many people saw the connection between Trump and internet trolling, but now everybody does. Establishment conservatives think Republicans have something to lose by taking on the media. As Gamers, Breitbart, Nigel Farage, Trump and I have all proved, they don't. The press has unloaded everything they have against us. And what has been the result? Gamergate gathered popularity for 2 years unstopped. Breitbart's one of the most popular news sources on the planet and the most popular political news source on social media. Nigel Farage, repeatedly condemned as a racist, took his party to unprecedented electoral successes and almost single-handedly drove the Eurosceptic movement that culminated in a successful vote for Brexit. Donald Trump, who attracted more media smears than anyone else combined, is the president of the United States. And then look at me. Other than Trump, Farage, and possibly Ann Coulter, is there anyone in the English-speaking world that the mainstream media makes more of an effort to smear, misrepresent, and then strategically ignore? Look where it's got me, though. I wake up every day hoping the mainstream media continues trying to destroy me because it's doing wonders for my bank balance. Journalists think that by smearing me as a racist and sexist, they're destroying my reputation, but actually, they're fueling my fame because no one believes a word they say. Their lies and their distortions heat my pool. In an age when nobody trusts the media, taking them on makes you popular. So I implore you to do what the media doesn't want you to do, which is tell the truth. Tell the truth bereft of politically correct niceties. Be patriotic. Tell offensive jokes. The media is going to hate you for it, and they'll call you names. They'll try to smear your reputation, but you don't need to worry anymore because no one's listening to them, except for a small group of their fellow blind, deaf, and dumb journalists. If I could tell my colleagues in the media just four things, they'd be this. 1. Everyone hates you. 2. No one is afraid of you. 3. No one believes what you say. And 4. Nobody owes you anything. If every journalist in America realized these 4 things, their behavior would transform overnight, immeasurably for the better, and the United States might finally get the 4th estate it deserves. In the meantime, you should just assume that all journalists are liars and frauds, unless proven otherwise. Chapter 7. Why Establishment Gays Hate Me. These days, people don't come out as gay, they come out as conservative. In February 2017, Chadwick Moore, a 33-year-old gay New York journalist, penned an article for the New York Post explaining his rapid shift from the left to the right. The article's headline was, "I'm a gay New Yorker and I'm coming out as conservative." Just 3 months before that, Moore had cast a ballot for Hillary Clinton. What happened? Well, it's simple. Chadwick got too close to the dangerous faggot. In September 2016, Moore had been assigned by Out to write a profile of me. The story was a gem. It was a rare piece of serious, nuanced journalism from the mainstream gay press, and probably the best thing Out had ever published. Its tone was impartial, describing the facts of my lifestyle, politics, and rise to fame, and there was no virtue signaling or moral grandstanding, or only a little bit. The profile wasn't completely free of bias, and likely it couldn't be, and it did include a trigger warning for fragile gay readers that they might encounter some conservative politics. They dressed me up in a clown costume for the accompanying photo shoot, and I deigned to appear in the outfit. The article's title was "Send in the Clown. Internet supervillain Milo doesn't care that you hate him." I didn't mind laughing at myself, so I let them put me in a clown costume and give me some harlequin makeup. I didn't mind. It did incorrectly call me a leader of the alt-right, as countless other publications had done, but I was willing to forgive the error because the rest of it was so good, and I didn't mind about the clown costume because, frankly, I still look sexy as fuck. Now, Out was utterly skewered for daring to examine me fairly. In addition to an immediate outbreak of rage on social media, more than 40 gay journalists signed an open letter condemning the magazine for failing to avoid fostering harm to queer people. Although the letter was directed against me, I admired the feat of getting 40 gay guys to agree on anything. But the gay establishment has gotten so used to trashing conservatives for a living that when one of their number fails to do so, they consider it some kind of hideous betrayal in need of a coordinated response. The personal attacks against Moore were more severe. Chadwick quickly found himself ostracized by his circle of liberal friends. In his New York Post coming out story, he describes how long-term friends and acquaintances began to turn their backs on him. He says, "My best friend, with whom I typically hung out multiple times per week, was suddenly perpetually unavailable. And finally, on Christmas Eve, he sent me a long text calling me a monster, asking where my heart and soul went, and saying that all our other friends are laughing at me. I realized that for the first time in my adult life, I was outside of the liberal bubble and looking in, and what I saw was ugly, lockstep, incurious, and mean-spirited." End quote. Moore was becoming, in internet parlance, red-pilled. Like Neo in The Matrix, his eyes had suddenly and dramatically been opened to a new reality. Now, aware of the left's intolerance, Moore had no choice but to reconsider his entire worldview. And that's how he ended up, coming out as a conservative in the pages of the New York Post. Bad news for you progressives, it's not just Chadwick. Other forward-thinking gays are also waking up to the dangers of embracing progressive intolerance. Dave Rubin, host of the Rubin Report, which was originally part of the Progressive Young Turks network, is another ideological immigrant from the left. Rubin's a former progressive who sensed the atmosphere of intolerance that was gathering steam in the movement, and he calls himself now a classical liberal, like I do. Here's how Rubin explained his position in a video for the conservative Prager University. Quote, "I'm a married gay man, so you might think I appreciate the government forcing a Christian baker or photographer or florist to act against their religion in order to cater, photograph, or decorate my wedding. But you'd be wrong. A government that can force Christians to violate their conscience can force me to violate mine." End quote. Rubin closed his videos by conceding that defending his classical liberal values had suddenly become a conservative position. It's my hope and my optimistic belief that more gays are going to wake up, smell the intolerance, and come to the same conclusion. Gays have been battling intolerance for decades, and only recently won the full support and acceptance of society. And how have we responded? by becoming equally intolerant, not against people who have sex differently from us, but against people who think differently than we do, and people who believe different things. Gays of the log cabin variety get merciless treatment from their peers. The rigid attitudes and prejudices of the fag establishment are going to be tough to break down. Take Lucian Wintrick, a gay Trump-supporting artist and photographer, and now journalist, who in 2016 unveiled a photography series called Twinks for Trump. His work featured half-naked, waifish-looking men wearing Make America Great Again hats. Just 5 hours after I wrote a column praising Wintrick for his transgressive art project, he was fired from the New York ad agency where he worked, apparently because so many people had called his office to complain about the photos. Thanks to conservative complacency, the art world today is a one-party state. Undeterred, Wintrick went on to host Daddy Will Save Us, the first ever pro-Trump art exhibit featuring pieces from a range of conservative figures, including me. I bathed naked in a vat of pig's blood representing persons who have died at the hands of Islamic extremists and undocumented immigrants. The response of the left was to bombard Wintrick's initial choice of art gallery with complaints, which caused the gallery to panic, cancel the event, and even threaten to sue Wintrick. A backup venue was found just in time, and the art show went ahead. Now imagine Madonna doing a video with twinks in MAGA hats. She wouldn't, of course, because these days she's too busy pandering to man-haters and aging gracelessly than saying anything bold or original. But Wintrick, like me, delights in causing outrage for a higher purpose. You don't really have to try very hard to offend people these days. Polite, respectable gay conservatives get exactly the same treatment from the left. So when mild-mannered entrepreneur Peter Thiel revealed his support for Donald Trump, gay website The Advocate published an article arguing that he could no longer consider himself part of the gay community. The message from this and from Chadwick Moore's experience is clear. Toe the party line or be thrown out of the clubhouse. In April 2013, I appeared on an edition of the British panel show 10 o'clock live to take part in a debate. The topic was gay marriage, a cause to which I was then opposed. My opposite number was Boy George, and it was a rare occasion in which I was not the most flamboyantly dressed person on set. I've got many objections to people like Boy George, not least of which is he was widely reported to have chained a rent boy to a radiator after a drug session. And it's clear that this guy is troubled, that he's had an interesting career, but that he's a complex, messy, and troubled person. Now, but the caricature that he plays on television, the God loves you, honey, seems to me to be a cop-out. His fans, who are themselves more messy and complicated, could do with a more complex and real gay role model, but what they get instead is a gay pride-friendly clown. My mere opposition to gay marriage, or at least my reservations about it, were enough to baffle the Channel 4 audience. In 2013, gay marriage had become a kind of litmus test of social acceptability. If you were for it, you were a normal human being, and if you were against it, you were a bigoted, malicious relic of the past, something to be dumped in the trash heap of history. Well, I was fashionably dressed, attractive and charming, so they didn't really know what to make of me. They couldn't throw names at me like they would if I were an elderly, overweight, reactionary, straight white male. Before the show was over, I was called a homophobic gay man and accused of being self-loathing for my opposition on cultural grounds to gay marriage. I pointed out that gay marriage reinforces the idea that being gay is a normal or acceptable lifestyle choice when it isn't and shouldn't be. The very term mainstream gay is at odds with everything homosexuals have always represented. But nonetheless, we're forced to use it because gays have become this monolithic political block. All gay people are expected to believe the same stuff. Mainstream gays, many of whom are happy to cast scorn on the lives of, say, conservative Midwestern families or Southern evangelical Christians, simply can't allow the possibility that someone might cast scorn on them. Take, for example, the popular drag queen Bianca Del Rio, whose famous slogan is, "Not today, Satan." When Candace Cameron, aka DJ Tanner, a famously proud Christian, wore a shirt with Bianca's slogan on it, Bianca turned around and called her a homophobic Republican. Candace responded that loving Jesus doesn't mean I hate gay people, but the damage was done, and to Bianca's nearly 1 million Instagram followers, DJ Tanner now hated fags. When the Daily Stormer called me a degenerate homosexual, they meant it as an insult, but I take it as a compliment. I became a homo precisely because it is transgressive, and I want homosexuality to continue being transgressive, degenerate, and even dangerous. One of the most alarming things I've witnessed over the past decade is how safe the gay community has become. As the cause of gay liberation advanced, our community's reputation went from feared purveyors of moral corruption to cuddly, married, middle-class suburbanites with neat haircuts. In short, we've stopped being dangerous. It almost makes me miss the time that we had to stay in the closet. The gay establishment is rightly horrified by that suggestion because it goes against everything they've been working to achieve since the 1990s. But before then, gay men used to delight in being transgressive. I'm old enough to remember. It was part of our identity. Consider gay icons of the past two centuries. Oscar Wilde relished appalling the stuffy sensibilities of Victorian society. These days, the Victorian pearl clutchers are the progressive left. When Wilde went to America, a prominent member of the clergy complained that someone who had engaged in such offences against common dignity was being received so warmly by high society. Wilde's famous novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, was chastised by one London newspaper as being, quote, unclean, poisonous, and heavy with the odours of moral and spiritual putrefaction, end quote. I mean, I'd live to get a review like that. And then there was Quentin Crisp, someone whose lifetime saw the rapid acceleration of gay rights. But the British writer and raconteur was even more shocking than Wilde. Not only did he find enjoyment in taking a bazooka to society's sacred cows, once describing Princess Diana, Britain's most cherished public figure, as trash, but he also loved to needle the gay rights movement. He infuriated campaigners with his willingness to question his own gay instincts and lifestyle, once even stating that gayness was something that ought to be avoided if possible. I mean, this stuff just wouldn't be allowed these days in the gay establishment. He was a mischievous, rebellious hero. Crisp was somebody who would tolerate no limits on his independence. In the first half of his life, he plainly ignored society's rules against his gay lifestyle. And in the second, he flouted the gay community's expectations of him as well. Writing in 1990, the bisexual belletrist Florence King bemoaned how the, quote, exclusivity of lesbianism, end quote, that she had known in the 1950s had vanished, done in by jargon-spewing socialists and earth mothers baying at the moon. In today's climate of irrational humanitarianism and primetime self-pity, the homosexuality inclined of both sexes have traded in their natural elitism for victimhood status. Just think of where gay people have lived and hung out in the past century. The seediest, most dangerous parts of town, Soho in London or Times Square in New York. These were also the gay parts of town. We were the outcasts, the corruptors. We were the devils, poisoning society and corrupting its morals. We were on the very edge of culture, pushing its boundaries, and we were doing it just by being ourselves. It's practically impossible for gays to transgress today. Hanging out in the Village, West Hollywood or Soho is hardly shocking or rebellious. Hipsters and trend followers crowd the streets, desperately clinging to the fading aura of forbidden cool that's rapidly melting away. Times Square is now a Disney store tourist trap. And just think of the horror of San Francisco. The unofficial capital of camp that once hated the man has become the man incarnate. Or as they'll call it, the gender non-conforming individual. Is there a city in America with a more moribund culture than San Francisco? I never cease to be amazed by the gay community's myopic eagerness to sacrifice everything that made our lifestyle unique, exciting, and socially valuable in exchange for heteronormative domesticity. Camille Paglia, the greatest feminist critic of all time, says it eloquently. Homosexuality, she writes, is not normal. On the contrary, it is a challenge to the norm. Nature exists whether academics like it or not, and in nature, procreation is the single relentless rule. That is the norm. Our sexual bodies were designed for reproduction. Penis fits vagina, and no fancy linguistics game playing can change that biological fact. Gay activism has been naive in its belligerent confidence that homophobia will eventually disappear with proper education of the benighted. Re-education of fractious young boys on the scale required would mean fascist obliteration of all individual freedoms. Furthermore, no truly masculine father would ever welcome a feminine or autistic son at the start, since the son's lack of virility not only threatens but liquidates that father's identity, dissolving husband into wife. Later, there may be public rituals of acceptance, but the damage will already have been done. Gay men are aliens, cursed and gifted, the shamans of our time. End quote. For decades, being gay has meant transgression and the violation of taboos. It has been an act of rebellion, an automatic entry pass into society's underworld. Our weirdness is our strength. It gives us an edge, a power, and a charm over everybody. Why would we want to give that up? Smart gays who've been around the block, like celebrity drag queen RuPaul, understand this instinctively. RuPaul correctly tells gay men they should strive to stay outside the matrix. He knows that going mainstream will be death to drag culture, and once in a while, he's brave enough to say so in interviews. But even drag culture is slowly feeling the influence of the perpetually offended. RuPaul himself was the victim of social justice censorship when the trans lobby forced his popular show, RuPaul's Drag Race, to stop using the phrase, "you've got she-male," in case any transgender people might possibly be offended. Being perverse is okay. Listen to Camille Paglia, my fellow fags. Realize you have an energy and a power others would kill to access. I never wanted to have a spouse and kids and a front lawn. I want to be hurled out of a nightclub at 3 a.m. in a drug-fueled stupor. Caring for my offspring will be the nanny's job. The gay establishment refuses to acknowledge that Donald Trump is a fabulously camp cultural figure. He's the drag queen president, and it's easy to see why so many gays I know secretly adore him. All that pizzazz and bluster, to say nothing of his strong position against Islamic homophobia. He oozes control and authority, and so obviously ought to be a gay icon. This is part of why I coined the nickname Daddy for him in the first place, which annoyed just about everyone. If gay people want to stay true to our historic reputation for transgression and boundary pushing, there's no better way to do it than by becoming conservative. MAGA is the new punk rock. Even punk legend Johnny Rotten recognizes this. He says in interviews how much he loves Trump winding up the establishment. Being openly gay is no longer a risky and dangerous affair. Being gay and openly conservative, well, that's another matter entirely. Here's how Chadwick Moore described his two experiences of coming out. Quote, "When I was growing up in the Midwest, coming out to my family at the age of 15 was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Today, it's just as nerve-wracking coming out to all of New York as conservative. But, like when I was 15, it's also weirdly exciting." End quote. There's a lesson for progressives here. Ramping up your political intolerance as you are currently doing will only backfire on you. It may cow a few easily intimidated, easily influenced gays into silence, but the best of us, the thrill seekers, the explorers, the dark adventurers who are drawn to the forbidden and dangerous, who push culture and society and innovation forward, will be heading straight for the door and we will not be coming back. Gay organizations pour money into programs to stop kids using the word gay in the playground as a slur or calling people faggots on the internet. But My Dangerous Faggot Tour, watched by millions of young people around the world, has done more to reclaim the words gay and faggot than all the anti-discrimination workshops ever staged in America. We aren't an underclass any longer, so why stick with the politics of victimhood? Peter Thiel was the first gay guy ever to openly discuss his sexual orientation before the Republican National Convention. He went up on stage before an audience of conservative delegates and announced that he was both proud to be gay and proud to be a Republican. The audience jumped to their feet and cheered. The historical significance of an openly gay businessman being applauded at the RNC may have been lost on pearl-clutching lefty fags, but to me, it was one of the greatest events in modern gay history. The party of Rick Santorum, in that moment, became the party of Peter Thiel. The progressive left will never admit this, but Thiel and I have, in less than a year, done more good for the image of gays in real America than decades of political advocacy from left-wing groups. We have shown America that not every gay man is a walking cardboard of tokenism like Ross Matthews. Mothers of the Midwest now know that their sons don't have to define their lives by the fact that they like sucking dick. Just as mainstream gays are no longer the ones pushing boundaries, they're also no longer achieving their stated goal, winning more acceptance and tolerance for gays in America. Every time a conservative-hating gay like Dan Savage goes on TV to berate Christians for their bigotry and small-mindedness, all he's doing is preaching to the liberal choir, who are already well on board with everything he's saying, and he's alienating the rest of America. It's right-wing fags like Thiel and me who are doing the rest of the work. There's something really naturally conservative about gays and our instincts. Male gays in particular are natural achievers. We tend to earn higher salaries than our straight counterparts, we have above average IQs, and we're less likely to become fat. We value aspiration, success, hard work and talent, all goals historically associated with the right. Ayn Rand, alongside Friedrich Hayek, another Austrian school economist, boldly proclaimed the value of wealth and humanity's quest for achievement. It's a perfect fit for gays who have counted some of history's greatest geniuses among our ranks. Alexander the Great, Sir Francis Bacon, Alan Turing, and Abraham Lincoln. Championing the fortunate, the successful, and the able have never been particularly popular. People are naturally inclined to sympathize with underdogs and to take pity on the less fortunate. But you occasionally need a Nietzsche or a Rand to remind society why striving for greatness, whether it's power, fame, wealth, or just breaking boundaries for the sake of it is important. The best way to help the less fortunate is not to proclaim their superior virtue, but to help them improve their condition. You need the extravagance of elites to motivate the less fortunate. And if there's one thing a good gay appreciates, it is, of course, extravagance. Now, we aren't all divas who crave opulence and fame, but enough of us are for it to be considered one of our natural characteristics. Good looks and glamour are two of my most cherished ideals, and as Somerset Maugham, who once described himself as a quarter normal and three quarters queer, admitted, the homosexual loves luxury and attaches peculiar value to elegance. I know I just said it, but once again, gays are skinnier than average, and our love of good clothes, good hairdos, and good aesthetics is well established. In the age of the fat acceptance movement, how can we stick with the left? We should look to Nietzsche for wisdom, not hideous queer studies professors. Being one of the last boundary pushers in the gay community pays dividends. At the end of 2016, readers of LGBTQ Nation named me Person of the Year. Despite an outraged response from the gay community, the publication respected their choice and acknowledged that I had successfully become the ultimate gay provocateur in a year of provocateurs. If you're a fag who craves the limelight as much as I do, take note. It is now conservative gays who get all the attention. Gay men are chaos incarnate. We're gods of mirth, of mischief, of danger, and innate perversion. And as society's subversive rebels, we're unencumbered by humdrum family ties, and we can go further than other people. We can smash taboos. We can achieve greatness. And we should never try to be normal. Family values are for straight people, not for us. Get married if you want, but don't pretend you won't secretly be browsing Grindr and scouting out darkened parks and public toilets behind your husband's back. And by the way, he'll be doing the same. But here's something you might not have considered. Christianity is not your enemy. It's a secret friend. You see, the devil needs the church to stay in business, and naturally mischievous gay men need a book of rules to break. We need to be told that we're wrong. We need to be told we're degenerate. Part of the blame for all this certainly falls with gays because we willingly accepted liberal victim programming for so long. Many in America still think this country's a terrible place for gays, ignoring the rest of the world. It isn't. Gays are often terminally insecure and vain. We think our problems are the only problems. In America, it's perfectly okay for two people not to like each other. Just because someone doesn't believe two gays should be able to get married doesn't mean they hate gay people. Tying someone up and throwing them off a roof, well, that's what real homophobes do. Social justice and progressivism are strangling gays and killing gay culture, and even Vice editors are noticing that it's Breitbart publishing radical gay editorials these days and provocative Britney Spears commentary, hosting gay porn star op-eds and referring to resident gay thoughts. That's a remarkable state of affairs for the left to find itself in. There's only one sentient issue that the gay establishment and gay charities should be focused on, and that is AIDS. These organizations treat misgendering and trans pronouns as a plague, while HIV infections continue to literally plague the gay community. Have they forgotten the men who died horrible, agonizing deaths only 20 or 30 years ago? An entire generation of gay men vanished. A gay rights leader so far gone that fighting for the right to a gay wedding cake becomes a priority ahead of 40,000 people diagnosed with HIV in the US in 2015. Are the semantics between marriage, civil union, and marriage equality so important that you disregard tragedy? Hysterical demands from dykes and trannies have brainwashed fags into fighting the wrong war. We've given over all gay rights battles to the dykes because we're too scared to voice what Florence King called the leading unpopular truth of homosexual life. Namely, that gay men and lesbians don't much like each other. In a normal country, they couldn't bear to be in the same room together, but in America, they're in the same minority group. Lesbians don't care about HIV rates. Why would they? It has no bearing on their lives whatsoever. You can't get HIV from scissoring. All lesbians care about is who wears the tux and who wears the dress at their tacky wedding. But it's time to stop lesbians from running the gay mafia, take them out of leadership positions in gay charities, and get lesbians back where they belong. In porn. People are sick of the gay establishment telling them what they're allowed to say and what they're allowed to read. Conservatives don't hate gay people. What they hate is being told what to think. I've received a standing ovation from 1,200 Louisiana Republicans appearing in drag, ridiculing fat people. I've made frat boys sit down for 2 hours and listen to me talk about my dark sexual perversions. These kids don't know who Amanda Lepore and Sharon Needles are, and they never will. But I've let them know it's okay to be themselves through my drag persona, Ivana Wall. I'm like every straight white male's gay hall pass. Look, I hope this chapter helps both the alt-right and mainstream gays understand my motivations. I do consider being gay to be wrong in some way, but I also quite like being wrong. I don't want everyone to be like me. But I think it's important that there are some people like me. Gays should be proud to be degenerates. So listen up, my fellow gays. Rescue what's left of gay culture and dump social justice, because it is so much more fun being bad. Chapter 8, Why Establishment Republicans Hate Me. In January 2016, I got into what I thought was a friendly Twitter spat with then-editor-at-large for Breitbart, Ben Shapiro. Ben's a sort of shorter and less successful version of me, who lost his entire audience by freaking out about Daddy. Shapiro's distaste for me and his distaste for Trump are related. They're part of a wider story of insecurity and of anger on the part of establishment rightists. Anger that their positions of power and influence over conservative politics are slowly slipping away. Anger that they're replaced by a new generation of fashionable and funny conservatives who have no time for the 1980s hang-ups that older conservatives are preoccupied with. I mean, yes, the fact that raising tax rates past a certain point actually decreases tax revenue is all very interesting, and a couple of times every decade when there's an election, people tend to pay attention to that kind of thing. But proselytizing the message is not the number one priority, or at least it shouldn't be, for conservative culture warriors. You see, we are nimble navigators who can get out to protests earlier because we're not waiting for our hearing aids to charge. And we care first and foremost about culture and not about politics. In 2016, there was only one type of political creature as upset as the left, if not more so, at the rise of Donald Trump, and that was establishment conservatives. Establishment conservatives were so upset by Trump, they made a pathetic attempt to torpedo his efforts against Hillary Clinton. Calling themselves Never Trump, some of them threw their support behind Clinton or the libertarian Gary Johnson, while others rallied around the laughable Evan McMullen, a former middle-ranking CIA operative that no one had ever heard of. Naturally, as one of the biggest and loudest Trump fans, I had the establishment come after me. After I objected to their attempts to brand every web-based Trump supporter a frothing neo-Nazi and anti-Semite, I attracted the attention of their queen bee, a rotund chap some listeners will remember, called Glenn Beck. Poor Beck. He's obsessed with me. He has, in various episodes on his sadly declining radio show, called me a 13-year-old boy and a Goebbels, whose writings are poison to the Republic. Poison to the Republic? Well, poison to his ratings, maybe. Beck was once the left's favorite punching bag, target of all their false accusations of racism. Unlike most establishment conservatives, Beck actually did things once upon a time. He once led a massive march on Washington, D.C. in defense of American heritage. Some estimates put attendance at nearly 500,000 people. Looking at the photos, it was probably more like 85,000, but that's a lot of people to get in one place, no matter what. Now, Beck's apologized for being too conservative in the past, and even pens columns for the New York Times today. In the run-up to the 2016 election, he threw his support behind Hillary Clinton, saying that opposing Trump was the moral and ethical choice, even if she were elected in his stead. There's a reason why conservatives like Shapiro and Beck, who were once the best the movement had to offer, now represent the past and the enemy, while people like me represent the future. Conservatives spent the last decade losing to the left, and they are tired of losing. And I don't just mean electoral defeats, although Mitt Romney's loss in 2012 could easily have been avoided by nominating a candidate that conjured up a compelling vision of America rather than a compelling vision of your local high school principal. No, conservatives lost in arenas that were more important than electoral politics: art, academia, and pop culture. Despite momentary political victories, the values spread by Hollywood eventually influenced the ballots cast in voting booths. Conservatives in America have lost culture, and until we win it back, our political victories are only going to be temporary setbacks against the steady advance of leftist principles. In fact, conservatives didn't simply lose the culture war. It's worse than that. They never showed up to fight in the first place. There has been no serious attempt from national-level politicians to push back against the liberal dominance in universities. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, which campus conservatives rely on to protect their free speech, does an excellent job fighting the worst excesses of left-wing censorship on campus, but the group was set up and is still run by moderate liberals. Heterodox Academy, a group of academics pushing for more political diversity in the social sciences, is spearheaded by Steven Pinker and Jonathan Haidt, also both liberals. It's not a bad thing that some liberals still care about free speech and pluralism, but why are we letting them do the heavy lifting? Where are all the conservatives? With the exception of a small number of news sites like Campus Reform and the College Fix, it's almost as if conservatives just don't care. Indeed, the few establishment conservatives who do care about campus issues and attract huge online followings of young people doing so privately admit their success is met with bemusement by fellow Beltway conservatives who wonder what the fuss is about and why more people aren't interested in the latest appropriations bill or Russian naval maneuvers in the North Sea. Young conservatives who are on the front lines of leftist intolerance every day have already fallen asleep. It's the same in showbiz. A conservative in Hollywood is like a gazelle in a pack of lions. Only the very nimblest will escape unharmed. Now, of course, there are rare exceptions like Clint Eastwood, whose conservative views fit with the John Wayne-esque tough guy persona he often plays on screen. Or Tim Allen, who was hilariously candid about his political views right before his successful sitcom was suddenly cancelled for some unknown reason. The rest have to wear lion suits and purr convincingly at feminists and Black Lives Matter activists. All this is a result of conservative laziness. For years, the only prominent right-winger who made any effort to organize the conservative Hollywood underground was Andrew Breitbart, a man despised by Beltway establishment types. Isn't it funny how successful conservative culture warriors always end up making enemies of the DC establishment left and right? It's almost as though establishment conservatives agree with leftists on everything except economics and foreign policy. Unsurprisingly, the rise of Trump has given the cultural conservative underground courage to come out in the open. Just look at Kanye West, one of my idols, who sort of basically came out as a Trump supporter after the election. This was, of course, immediately linked to alleged mental health problems by Perez Hilton. Roseanne Barr, one of the funniest people walking the planet, has openly supported Trump, and for good reason. She made a career, let's remember, out of speaking directly to the working class, just like Donald Trump, and just like me. And at the 27 Grammys, when previously unknown singer-songwriter Joy Villa shocked attendees by wearing a dress bearing the words Trump and Make America Great Again, she saw her album sales rise by 54,350,100%, proving that conservatism in showbiz can in fact be the opposite of career ending. You just have to do it with courage and style. There's of course a long way to go. For every Kanye, there's an Adele who told an audience she was embarrassed for Americans because of Trump. Does anyone remember what happened to the Dixie Chicks when they said almost the exact same thing about George W. Bush? Their CDs were literally crushed by tractors. Nevertheless, the courage I'm seeing from conservative entertainers and celebrities in the wake of Trump's victory makes me optimistic that things will change, albeit perhaps without the help of the conservative establishment. Stuffy Beltway types really don't know what to do with us. We have introduced a brand new type of conservative to them. Listen, not everyone in the conservative movement is going to be cool and hip. I get that. But let's at least aim to attract new members who still have both their hips. Could it be that establishment conservatives want to lose? Cuck became a popular insult in 2016. Its original definition was a man whose woman gets slammed by another dude, but it's now become a byword for needlessly relinquished manliness, for selling out, and for caving in. Calling someone a cuck is an expedient way to denote a beta male or a coward. See pretty much every Republican running against Donald Trump in the 2016 election. Like a lot of other conservative trailblazers, I'm constantly being told by the establishment types that I'm a clown. Yet for 30 years, these guys have achieved nothing on campuses. In barely two, I quite literally set the higher education system in America on fire. So if I'm a clown, what does that make them? There's nothing contradictory about appreciating Wagner's Der Ring des Nibelungen and also getting a kick out of calling Amy Schumer a boring cunt. And there's nothing wrong with talking about very serious subjects using satire, silliness, and shock value. For instance, at one of my shows, which was called No More Dead Babies and dedicated to the evils of abortion, I handed out individually signed and numbered photos of dead fetuses like they were concert memorabilia. How many commentary writers can claim they got 400 20-year-olds to think about the moral consequences of abortion in a single day, to say nothing of the hundreds of thousands who watch the show on YouTube? When liberals come over to the dark side, they become friends with me and reluctant admirers of Trump. They don't become Shapiro or Jonah Goldberg devotees. You can see the sense of mischief and joy in classical liberals who leave the left, like Dave Rubin. And when unexpected cultural figures like Azealia Banks announce their support for Republican candidates, it's Trump they go for, not Ted Cruz. Conservatives could learn a thing or two about how to beat the left from web culture. Godfrey Elfwick is the pseudonym of a brilliant British troll who portrays an exaggerated satire of a social justice warrior on Twitter, complete with a bio that describes him as a genderqueer Muslim atheist. For nearly 3 years now, he's almost never broken character, and his persona has fooled many an onlooker, including the incredibly annoying Chelsea Clinton and the BBC, who invited him on radio to explain why Star Wars is racist and sexist. Acts of high-impact trolling like Elfwick's, which expose the left through ridicule, are far more likely to turn heads and change minds than the most brilliant column in a conservative weekly. While consistently missing opportunities to beat the left in winnable fights, conservatives have done virtually nothing to lay down deeper roots in culture. Besides a few investments from David Koch and the Spectator's art section, what is there really? It's no match for the myriad of leftist and government-supported entities